This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Media is a powerful tool in shaping our cultural narrative. It also guides us in our understanding of how we see others and ourselves. A new podcast examines the significance of accurate cultural representation from the lens of the Black queer experience. It's called Being Seen, and it's just one of the topics that we'll cover today on Back Channel, our series Connecting Culture and Context. We'll also look at the way TV and film have shaped our perceptions of law enforcement, and we'll examine the gatekeepers who decide what representations are made in media and entertainment through a conversation about Rada Blank's film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and a critical look at PBS Butt Documentaries. Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown join me now. Mark is James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Natalie, Mark, welcome back to the State of Things.
Hey, what's up, Frank?
Also on Back Channel today, Darnell Moore, who is the host of the podcast Being Seen. He is an activist and author of No Ashes in the Fire, Coming of Age, Black and Free in America. Darnell, welcome to the State of Things and welcome to Back Channel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about Being Seen and the significance of that title, what it means to be seen, and particularly with the focus that you have chosen on the Black queer experience. Tell us more about that decision and how you framed this podcast.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the idea behind it really was to highlight, center, celebrate Black, queer, gay, bi, and trans men, folk who in many ways are hyper-visible, I think, in terms of how, you know, the society and culture talks about LGBTQI people, but also at the same time, hyper-invisible, invisibilized. In a moment right now, for example, where we're heralding and lifting up the mattering of Black lives, it's often important for me to remind people that some of the Black are also queer and trans and non-binary, and they are contributing to art and entertainment and political movements and so much else. But it's not true that we are often highlighting those contributions. So this is an opportunity for us to provide space for people to be lifted up, for Black, queer, trans, and bi men to be lifted up, for them to be seen in a moment when so many forces are at work, muting and muting voices and invisibilizing the labor that's contributed by.
Mark and Natalie, I know you have questions. Mark, do you have a question for Darnell?
Yeah, Darnell, you know, I've known of your work for some time. I've known you for about a decade. And I think one of the things that was always striking to me about your activism is that you were someone who, to some extent, were very comfortable kind of being in the back room, not out front. And I think the thing that's interesting about this new podcast is that it really does put you and your vision and your activism out front as you talk about trying to create, you know, more platforms and more voices, you know, for Black queer audiences, but actually, you know, Black voices in general, you know, because that's inclusive of LGBTQ communities. Talk a little bit about what it's been like to come out front, you know, in a project like this.
Yeah, for sure. I love you, Mark. Mark has been one of the reasons your work and your voice has been one of the forces that have shaped me. But it's true that there are, you know, I've done a lot of work, you know, within the movement for Black Lives, been part of very localized organizing work, and was really taught by, like, the people in my community that the way that we can sort of do the work and have impact is just by doing it, and without sort of making a big old a loud noise about it. But what's interesting is, after having done so much within behind the scenes and thinking about how stories are told about the way that either movements are formed, the ways that contributions to the culture are lifted up, and realizing how many people I know, sometimes my own self, have been blotted out of those narratives, moved me to remember why it's important for us, when given the opportunity to tell our own stories on our own terms, to push back against that sort of project of invisibility, and to say, no, I actually was here. You know what I'm saying? And to do that on our own terms. So Being Seen was another opportunity for me to be able to do that.
Natalie?
Yeah, thank you. Darnell, it's just really wonderful to have you on the show and being seen as a beautiful offering. One of the things that struck me about it while listening is that it felt both universal, like inclusive, like I, as a cisgendered heterosexual Black woman, could listen to it and hear and see myself because of the richness of the conversation. But I also was very aware of the fact that it was a space, a safe space as well for a community that I'm not a part of, you know, which is Black, queer, gay, bi, and transsexual men. Was that intentional? Were you trying to make it both inclusive and exclusive at the same time? Or is that even like maybe a strategy to really speak to the Black community about how we exclude and don't include this part, this very vibrant part of our community?
That's a great question. There's something rich about singularity. And what I mean by that, you know, both as a writer, as a media maker, I am always super aware of the way that stories, when we're telling the truth about those stories, right? Like, with, you know, I've often been taught to sort of write the universal story, write a story that everyone can find themselves in. And as a Black writer, as a Black artist, I know it's also true that white writers and white artists have not been asked to write a universal story. They write the ones that I was groomed to read are writing very singularly. So when I think about what I mean by singularity, I mean, What would it mean when we were writing? Like, I wrote a book, No Ash in the Fire. It's about Camden. It's about a particular period in time, a particular people. And interestingly enough, I think in that singular narrative, other people can find themselves in it. They can find essences and parts of it through which they can relate. As one example, I had the lawyer who was reviewing the book for, you know, issues of sort of making sure I don't get sued for telling stories about other people's lives, a white woman from Texas, and she read this book about Camden, this little Black boy, gay boy from Camden, and was like, oh my gosh, I read the book and I felt so connected to so many parts of it. And I laughed. I was like, how? Because I didn't imagine you, right, like in the audience in my mind when writing it, but yet she found herself in it. In the same way that Moonlight, a very singular narrative about characters who are in Miami, right? A world that is very singular, and yet so many people were able to find themselves in it. So I think the tactic is, if folk are listening, there should be some aspects of this, because we're all human. We all experience isolation. We all experience community. We all experience intimacy or not, right? That those elements can sort of surface in the narrative, and that people can connect onto them and see that even if I'm not queer or trans or non-binary, there is still something connecting me to those who might be different than myself.
I'm talking to Darnell Moore, a writer and an activist, also Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown on Back Channel today on The State of Things. Darnell, I want to play a clip from the first episode of your podcast, which might amplify or reveal perhaps another aspect of the answer you just gave in Natalie's question. This clip from the first episode featuring film director Lee Daniels.
I mean, it's bad enough that I got to deal with some racist mother out there that's going to stop me from my creation coming to life. None of my films have ever been embraced, including Billie Holiday, by the studio system. You know, I've had to raise money for all of my films directly myself. And so I can tolerate that, I guess, but what I don't like is, you know, being shunned by my own people for being gay. And that's the first, you know, I'm out there doing it alone, you know?
Lee Daniels featured in the podcast Being Seen. Back channel today, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, as well as Darnell Moore. Talk a little bit more about that, about these otherness within the various groups, as you say, that you're writing about, that Black Lives Matter. You want to make sure that the Black Lives include all Black lives. And that seems to me what Lee Daniels was speaking to.
you know, and I think it's an important point to be made, and one that requires a bit of nuance. You know, so Lee, if we can't, there, look, in Hollywood, there are already a limited number of Black filmmakers that exist at that level, right? So that's, let's acknowledge that. So you're in the world trying to create art in a world that wasn't set up for you to belong, to even have you there, because it's been white streamed, it's been sort of white male streamed. So you're in that, and then you know, you're also a Black gay person maneuvering through that space. Now, the thing that I always say is, I always, before I offer what I'm about to say, have to make the claim that, you know, Black communities are no more homophobic, trans antagonistic than any other. I mean, we exist in a U.S. context which legislates against, in many ways, our being. But it's also true, right, that we have to acknowledge the ways that we can both have feet on our necks. We can experience racial antagonism and a variety of other things, white supremacy, and even while and still have our feet on somebody's neck at the same time. Part of the work that I've done is to help folk within the communities in which I'm part to examine that, to think about the ways that we often are tend to sometimes do to each other what the system and what white supremacists, bell hooks would say white supremacists, cis heteropatriarchy does to us, right?
I'm going
to
take a break here, Darnell. I want to take a break right here and come back. Darnell Moore, the host of the Being Seen podcast, Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown. It's Back Channel today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Back Channel today, our series Connecting Culture and Context. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Darnell Moore is with us, too. He's an author and activist and host of Being Seen, the podcast that explores the impact of cultural representations from a Black queer perspective. And Darnell, we're reducing the stigma around HIV and AIDS is also a big focus of the podcast. How are you trying to change that conversation?
Yeah, for sure. The podcast is supported by Vive Healthcare, whose work is focused on ending the HIV epidemic and its impact. You know, Black men, Black gay men, Black men who don't even identify as gay or otherwise, and Black women, Black people have been disproportionately impacted by HIV's impact. So a big part of what we want to do is to use these narratives, these stories, to one, destigmatize, to remove stigma, help people to think about how to remove stigma, and also to demystify conversations around HIV. HIV is just as much of a part, should be just as much of a part of a movement to bring a type of freedom and safety and equity to Black communities as anything else.
Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown, I know we're getting close to the end of this conversation with Darnell, and if you have other questions, I know one question I have along those lines is that HIV/AIDS is something that has certainly dropped from our screen, and talk about being seen, visible at a moment, and then has really kind of left our visibility. Tell us more about that and the importance of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's also important to think about the moment in which we're having this conversation. We're having a conversation in the middle of a global pandemic, right, that also revealed the ways that structural inequities exacerbate, you know, things like global diseases, viruses within our communities and the state's response to that. There are many ways that the state's response to the COVID pandemic was similar to the state's response to HIV. It's also similar in terms of who's disproportionately impacted. We know that Black and Latinx folk in this country, in the U.S., had been more susceptible to contracting and or dying from COVID in the same ways now that we have to think about HIV, not because our bodies are somehow more prone to it, but because of the systems of inequity that are set up that allow for that type of disproportionate impact.
We're going to move on pretty soon from this part of the conversation. Darnell, it will be a shame to have to lose you as we continue our conversation, but I want to check with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown, see if they have other questions for you. Mark?
Yeah, I just want to follow up in terms of what Darnell was just talking about. You know, we've heard these conversations now about what the low COVID rates look like in Africa, and people have been surprised. But part of it is that, you know, they had already set up an infrastructure to deal with the Ebola virus a few years ago. And so it's unconscionable that on some level, given what HIV meant to this country and the way that it absolutely, you know, impacted Black and brown and queer communities, that, you know, that because we didn't deal seriously with that infrastructure 40 years ago, in some ways, we're still incapable of dealing with an infrastructure to deal with these issues of viruses.
Natalie Bullock Brown, closing comments or other questions for Darnell?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, I was really struck and touched by what you say, Darnell, in your Guardian article, when you say maybe what it means to be human is to accept that we might touch something akin to healing only after we accept that brokenness is the entry point into transformation. Black people know that we are not the problem in need of fixing. America is. Could we also say that that is a part of what being seen is trying to say about the Black queer community?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. And I want to acknowledge that, you know, so many of the people that I interviewed who have triumphant stories, ways in which they've contributed to the world and, you know, thought and created on a behalf of their communities, even if sometimes those communities weren't fighting or creating with them in mind. So sometimes, you know, that when we think about their shame and stigma and all of the things that come up, the brokenness, which is a result of systemic issues. The brokenness is not because we're queer or trans. I'm not broken because I'm a Black gay man. I live in a world that it has at every turn, white supremacy, antagonism against queer people, you know, the ways that we were sort of riled against as working poor people growing up in Camden, New Jersey. I live in a world having to maneuver against those things. It's a feat, one, to overcome them. But it's also important to name that a consequence of some of those arrows that come our way are the types of heaviness that we carry, especially as men in the midst of patriarchy.
Darnell Moore, author, activist, and host of the podcast Being Seen, and that Guardian article that Natalie made reference to was just published today, and we'll have a link at our website, stateofthings.org. Darnell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you all so much.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, still here for Back Channel. We're going to turn to Megan Thee Stallion's performance on Saturday Night Live earlier this month and the op-ed she wrote for the New York Times defending her use of the phrase, as though she had to defend it, protect Black women. And for those who missed it, here is a little bit of Megan Thee Stallion's performance on Saturday Night Live.
The most disrespected, unprotected, neglected person in America is the Black woman. Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair, the color of your skin, the shape of your nose? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet?
Daniel Cameron is no different than the sellout Negroes that sold our people into slavery by statute.
We need to protect our Black women and love our Black women. Because at the end of the day, we need our Black women. We need to protect our Black men and stand up for our Black men. Because at the end of the day, we're tired of seeing hashtags about Black men.
That was some of Megan Thee Stallion's performance on Saturday Night Live earlier this month. Natalie Bullock Brown, what was your initial reaction to that moment?
I missed the actual, I think I only saw the second performance of Megan, so I had to catch that performance and that moment on YouTube. You know, but I just really appreciate Megan for her insistence on not only saying what she says, playing the Malcolm X quote, the Tamika Mallory quote about D.A. Cameron in Kentucky. And then even on the stage, you know, part of the set design was, you know, in big block letters, protect Black women. You know, for an entertainer who is most likely, especially as a Black woman, going to be told to stay in her lane, stay out of politics. You don't know what you're talking about. We just want to see you perform. You know, you don't have a mind really to comment on such things. I admire and I respect that Megan is using her platform to, shine a light on these issues, especially as she herself has had to deal with not being protected in several situations, you know, where her life was pretty much endangered. So it speaks to the fact that there is a running theme in this country of Black women not being protected, not having a voice. And when something happens to us, it's not deemed important. It's where our lives are not valuable. And she's really sounding the alarm on that.
Mark, what about you?
You know, I had a conversation on Twitter with an older guard activist, Black male activist, who wanted to make the point, you know, because of Megan Thee Stallion's physicality, her choice of clothes, she felt as though that undermined her message and thought it would be important for her to talk to some of the elder women, you know, in the movement, the Sonia Sanchez's and the Nikki Giovanni's and what have you. And what struck me about that is that, you know, this is someone in critiquing Megan Thee Stallion is not at the same time offering the same kind of critique, you know, to Black men like Tory Lanez, who literally shot her in the foot. So this isn't just, you know, something that's theoretical for Megan, right? This is something that is very real. And I've also been struck by the fact that when women performers stand out and speak truth to power, they're not given the same kind of support and affirmation that we see in terms of Black men doing those same things. You know, so if Megan Thee Stallion had said that she was starting a political party, you know, 3 weeks before a national election, if Cardi B had said, you know, that she was going to create a contract for Black America and make a deal with Donald Trump, they wouldn't have any latitude in that, in the ways that we now see Black men like Diddy Combs and Ice Cube getting the kinds of latitude, though it's very clear in terms of this political season, definitely, that Black women, whether in terms of folks like Megan Thee Stallion or the more established Black women politicians who've been working with the Democratic Party, are really laying the groundwork for this particular political moment for Black people.
Natalie, where does that leave the conversation in some ways, given what you said earlier when you were talking with Darnell, that the problem, the brokenness is America? America is the problem. And yet when something like this happens, then we hear about Megan's physique, we hear about her clothes, we hear about her choice of language, all the things that aren't anything, that aren't the point. The point is what's wrong with America that she illustrates. But then is the audience then, that broken America that needs to really come to reckoning about itself in order to be healed? Or is there, you know, these internal conversations too among communities that have found themselves, at the wrong end of this kind of cultural argument? Where's the conversation? Where's the audience for this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I was thinking as Mark was, you know, talking about these insane comments that have recently come from Ice Cube and P. Diddy Combs, and Snoop Dogg by way of, you know, supporting these comments. I was thinking about an article I saw in Blavity.com, which is a Black publication, online publication, that spoke to data that suggests that Trump has been targeting, and actually there are pollsters who have noted this as well, but that Donald Trump has intentionally targeted Black men. Not so much because he thinks that he can win them over to vote for him in large numbers, but he just wants to get enough of them to not vote for Biden. So it's likely that he's trying to get them to not vote at all or vote for him. And I posted this article on Facebook, and, you know, as per usual, there were many comments from Black men and even white women. I mean, it was like it ran the gamut, who were like, well, we can't buy into this narrative, and Black men are smarter than that, all these things. But Mark just gave us like two examples of men with huge platforms who have influence and who are caping for Donald Trump. So the reality is when we think about that audience that you're asking about, when you think about the systems that are embedded in our culture of patriarchy and sexism and misogyny and toxic masculinity coming out of patriarchy, right? These are the things that really feed this type of argument, you know, and certainly for someone like Ice Cube or P. Diddy, you know, we have to really break down what is not being said, what's not being communicated by these alliances that are being made with Trump. And it's, you know, there's a class issue that we're also having to face and confront. So there's a lot going on, but I think we have to be honest about the fact that there are these systems that certainly create an environment where Black women, when it comes down to it, we vote in a block, and we're going to make sure that not only we, but Black men and the most vulnerable are taken care of, but that does not happen in the reverse. It does not. We are not taken care of in the same way, and we have to reckon with that.
I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker, teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University, Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. It's Back Channel today on The State of Things. So along those lines, I want to shift gears a little bit, but talk about where some of those ideas and impressions come from that can support and form the foundation for and then continually support patriarchy, white supremacy, some of these ideas that have been built in, baked into the system and continue to be supported. I want to return now to a piece that Mark wrote for a project called Abolition for the People about the way TV and film have shaped our view of the police. So here's a promotional clip from a police crime drama from the 1960s and 70s, the FBI.
The challenge, organized crime. To meet it, you need a special breed of men.
FBI, hold it!
Dedicated men.
La Cosa Nostra is a cancer in this country. Pretending it isn't there won't make it go away. It has to be cut out every time it's found.
The stories, they're real. The action, decisive.
He's here, and he's a killer. And I want him found before he can kill anyone else.
These men are killers. You and Miss Simpson are next. All we're asking for is the chance to save your lives.
The pace is swift. The stakes, they're high. The FBI, in color, on ABC.
There's the promo for the police crime drama from the 60s and 70s, back in the time when not everybody had a color TV, apparently. It's Back Channel today on The State of Things. That was called the FBI. But Mark, talk about this idea of propaganda and how it's imprinted on our culture a long time ago and sort of remains the influence, I guess, of dramas like that.
Yeah, so, you know, first a little background about the project. You know, Abolition for the People is a project that was pulled together by Colin Kaepernick's publishing company, Kaepernick Publishing, and the Level platform on Medium. They brought together 40 prominent writers to talk about and activists to talk about issues around abolition. And so Amir Logans, who helped edit this project, asked me to write a little bit about propaganda. And I wanted to at least place it into this love that I had for cop shows when I was a child. My father and I watched the FBI on television. We watched, you know, the Sunday night movies on NBC. So we watched McMillan and Wife and McCloud and Columbo. And I had developed enough of a taste for those shows that I started to watch shows on my own, like Adam 12 and also SWAT. But it was without any of the real history of what those police forces meant in that particular historical moment. I watched the FBI and didn't know anything about the role that the FBI was playing in terms of undermining the Black Liberation Movement, specifically targeting the Black Panther Party. Many of the scripts for the FBI, you know, were vetted by J. Edgar Hoover because he wanted to control the narrative about what the Federal Bureau of Investigation was doing at the time. When I watched Adam 12 and when I watched SWAT, I didn't realize that SWAT was something that was actually created by police captain Darryl Gates, you know, the same Daryl Gates that were responsible for the LAPD in the 1980s that creates gangster rap, that's responsible for the beating of Rodney King. And he was the one who came up with the idea with SWAT, you know, this kind of special tactics force that would go in and quickly defuse situations. And the fact that SWAT was the first time it was deployed in L.A. was to attack a Black Panther Party office in December of 1969 in Los Angeles, only days after we saw the Chicago Police Department do the same thing in Chicago, killing Fred Hampton. And so, you know, the idea behind Copaganda is that we watch this stuff on television and we get a sense of how we should interact with the police, in which the police are always do-gooders, right, who are doing the best for the society. And the criminals who are policed and over-policed deserve to be policed the way that they are.
Yeah, and I think your point, too, is that it's not as innocent as it may have sounded. A lot of this was deliberate, coming from the FBI, coming from the police, to sanitize what they were actually doing in those communities at the time these things were airing.
Absolutely.
Natalie Bullock Brown, what's your take on this?
Well, I had a similar experience. I remember the names of some of the shows that Mark mentioned. Certainly, I had deja vu listening to that FBI clip. But the shows that I really remember and that I think had an impact on me in terms of what I thought policing was about, or, you know, what to expect from the police, were shows like Perry Mason and Hawaii Five-0, Dukes of Hazzard and Miami Vice. And these were really sanitized versions of, you know, policing in America, I think. And I have to say that, you know, because of the way that my engagement with the police when I was growing up all the way into my years in college often turned out, I don't ever remember being afraid of the police, of being afraid of being pulled over, or anything like that. And I'm sure that that had a lot to do with, you know, growing up watching the likes of Roscoe P. Cotrane on Dukes of Hazzard. And, you know, just not having a sense, a consciousness, as Mark was saying, of what was going on, you know, in terms of the brutality that Black folks were dealing with in the rest of the country. I was insulated from that, so I did not know what that was about.
Did that change for you, and how did it change?
I think it did change. I think Law and Order, that series, which I loved for a long time, ironically, but I think that it had a really, I think it had an impact on how I saw the police. And I remember a moment when the first time I remember being afraid of the police, and that was a moment in college. I think I was a junior. I wasn't even on campus, but I was with my boyfriend who was Black, and we got pulled over, and I was terrified. I mean, I'd never felt such fear. It was a long time since then that I felt it. And so that was the moment, I think, that kind of changed things for me. I think there have been movies like Boys in the Hood, and the racist Black cop that is portrayed in that film had an impact. The film Crash had an impact. I began to think more critically about the role of police in Black communities. And certainly as I became more politically conscious, you know, I realized that there's a huge disconnect between what we see on television and other mass media and what is actually happening in the streets.
Mark, how does that play out now? If you think about the difference, that disconnect that Natalie's talking about, if you've been watching the FBI and SWAT and, you know, you think that they're the good guys and they're on your side, but that conflicts with your experience as a Black man on the street who's being pulled over constantly and not being told what for. There might be a dissonance there in your perception, but for white people who are not pulled over, they are not, in fact, they're disproportionately less, they're pulled over less, all the statistics show. How much of an impact does that have, and how have things changed, do you think, with social media and the idea that we're now exposed to a different picture with some of what we're seeing displayed in video, the way the media is now showing some of the truth of policing in our streets? Is consciousness changing along with it?
I think very little at this point in time. I mean, it's going to be a long process. I mean, we're talking about the role that popular culture plays historically in framing ideological sensibilities for some folks. You know, we didn't even talk about things like reality television and shows like Cops and the way that was connected to the way that people viewed black criminality in the 1990s and a fear of black criminality, even when black criminality wasn't a possibility in some of the places in middle America where white America lived. I think it's still a very real challenge because popular culture in many ways affirms the point of view of folks, you know, who don't have the kind of experiences. And there are more people watching these television shows than are on Twitter, right? You know, mm-hmm. Twitter is kind of a silo in and of itself where we're having these conversations. And very rarely does it bleed the way that it should to into mainstream culture. I mean, we're starting to see some changes now because of everything that's happened in 2020. I think of a show like All Rise, you know, which was a CBS show that launched last year as trying to talk more humanely about the criminal justice system and policing as well as what happens in the courthouse. I've heard some inklings about different shows that want to be able to touch on issues of driving while black and police profiling, you know, but this is stuff that, you know, they have been able to do this for 50 years. It's only in this moment that they chose that we want to tell a different kind of story.
Well, speaking of that very topic, Driving While Black, I guess it brings us to the documentary that is now the PBS documentary, Driving While Black, Race, Space, and Mobility in America as a Case Study. Let's listen to a snippet from early in that documentary.
Mobility is essential to freedom. I think the automobile is emblematic of the importance and the value of mobility in a free society. But it also goes beyond mobility, and it allows us to understand the way that African Americans have moved forward in this country and the way that African Americans have been pushed back.
Gretchen Soren, historian and one of the directors of the new PBS documentary, Driving While Black, Race, Space, and Mobility in America. Natalie Bullock Brown, tell us about the film and how it hit you.
So Driving While Black, as you said, is co-directed by Gretchen Soren, who's a black historian at the State University of New York. I can't remember if she's in Stony Brook or which location she's at, but she co-directs the film with Rick Burns, who's the younger brother of Ken Burns. It's a two-hour documentary aired earlier in the week. I think it's very well done. I mean, it does labor to give us context, to really go back and explain the foundational pieces of, you know, Driving While Black. I'm talking about slavery and all that comes out of that, all of the ways that black bodies are white people seek to control and contain white bodies, not only during slavery, but after slavery, and how that leads into the Jim Crow era and the onset of automobile manufacturing and black people being able to access automobiles so that they can travel. I do a lot of work and thinking about accountability in documentary filmmaking and what it means to tell ethical stories. And, you know, I think the thing that bothered me the most about this film, in spite of all that it strives to do, and I think does fairly well, is that I just felt like it was triggering because there's a lot of footage that's contemporary of cell phone footage and maybe even television footage of black drivers being pulled over and harassed, brutalized by the police. And it almost feels like it's a pile-on, that it's intended, of course, to make a point, right? Mm-hmm. But what it does for black viewers, I think, is it triggers and traumatizes all over again.
How would you have done it differently to make the point without the triggering?
Well, I think that there's a way to, well, first of all, I think, you know, there, so Gretchen Soren is Black and she co-directs. The editor is one of the producers is a Black man named Amir Lewis. So first of all, I would want there to be Black input, knowledgeable Black input into how do you shape this story so that it doesn't do what I'm talking about. It doesn't trigger and traumatize. But I also think that there's a way that Black stories really require being told by Black people who have experienced what is being talked about. And the extent to which Dr. Soren and Amir are, you know, able to bring to bear their lived experience onto the film is not clear, but I do feel that it's clinical in a way that, you know, that doesn't have to be. And there's a way to make people feel what it feels like, the trauma, the fear, the anxiety of being Black while driving or driving while Black, that's missing. And I wish it could have taken cues from Lovecraft Country. There are plenty of scenes where Black folks are trying to hurry up. They're driving while Black. They're trying to get out of a sundown county or some other thing. But I think there's a way to do it. But I think you have to be Black. I think you have to be a part of that community and know something about that experience to really translate that well.
Mark, what was your reaction to this documentary?
I agree with Natalie, at least to the extent that I thought the film was too long. I didn't need a 20-minute primer on the history of slavery for them to be able to tell the story. And, you know, while Driving While Black is something we talk about in a contemporary moment, and we see some of that, of course, in the footage towards the end that Natalie talks about, for me, the most refreshing parts of the film were really talking about the Great Migration, was talking about what it meant, you know, for Black folks to pursue leisure by having access to a car. The number of times, whether it's me or my peers when we were kids, you know, get sent down south, you know, to be with family that's still there. You know, that's a part of the story. The story is about Black leisure spaces that Black people can only drive to. I'm thinking about specifically the Marsalis Manor motel, you know, which was, you know, created by Branford and Whit Marsalis's grandfather, Ellis Marsalis Sr., which made me think of memories of taking summer trips from the Bronx up to Ulster County to Peg Leg Bates's resort. Because Black folks, just like, you know, with a great wide open from really white Americans, which they didn't have to concern themselves about where was I going to go and where was I going to get gas and whether I was going to get, you know, stopped by the cops. For many Black folks, it shows the ingenuity, whether we're talking about the Green Book or some of these other, you know, books that help people travel. It talks about the ingenuity of Black folks within the system of segregation to be able to still pursue leisure and freedom and mobility.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown on Back Channel Today. You're listening to it on The State of Things. Well, let's stick with this subject of documentaries on PBS, Natalie. I know you have some thoughts about this, and you talked about the sort of clinical way in which the experience was portrayed, in your opinion, in Driving While Black, a style very reminiscent of Ken Burns with the talking heads and then the music under. And I wonder to what extent you've had some thoughts about equity, particularly with PBS documentaries and its worship of Ken Burns.
Wow. Well, that's a loaded question, Frank. I think that PBS over the years has promoted Ken as, you know, as king of docs. He is America's storyteller, according to PBS. And there's a really great piece that a Asian American filmmaker named Grace Lee recently wrote for the Ford Foundation that talks about how she worked on the 5-hour Asian American series that aired on PBS. And she lamented at the fact that, you know, they had to get 5 hours of the history of Asians in America, that was all that they had, was 5 hours. And Ken gets 2 hours or 4 hours coming up to tell the story of American Buffalo. And she and Grace make the point, you know, if bison get 80% of the time that Asian Americans do, like, what are we saying? Especially when PBS is supposed to be, it was created to be this place for diverse voices to have a home. So I think it's really something that we have to contend with. And in the doc community, just like in the larger society, there is a shift. There's a racial reckoning that is happening around who gets to tell these stories about marginalized communities, and why is it that the gatekeepers are giving the resources and the funding and all the other things that are needed to make a good documentary? Why is it being given to white filmmakers? Why can't Black filmmakers tell their own stories? And how do we shift? What are you willing to change in order to level that playing field? And I think that there's going to be a tipping point at which, you know, some things do shift, and you will see more resources, hopefully, going to communities of color so that they can tell their own stories and tell them really well.
Well, Mark, I'd like to get your thoughts on that. And also with regard to the conversation we had earlier, just the way that documentary has been framed and now the Ken Burns documentary being kind of the model, whether or not we have that to fight against when there's other ways to tell stories as well. And not to mention who should be telling the story. And I want to get your thoughts on that.
I remember almost 30 years ago having a conversation with Madison Davis Lacey, who was working on, at the time, his documentary on Richard Wright. I remember asking him what kind of documentaries he wanted to do, and he mentioned Margaret Walker among many of them that he wanted to do. But he understood then that he would never get the type of support from PBS or elsewhere to be able to make the films that he wanted. And how he made a living, ironically, was to work on Ken Burns' Jazz. And this is, you know, at an early moment in Ken Burns' career, but, you know, Ken Burns has become that model. It's the model that I believe PBS believes is a model that they can help fund the work that they do, right? So it becomes a challenge for Black filmmakers to have to fit into that kind of process in order to make film. And it's a challenge, right? I think we're going to have to find new funding sources for independent supports of Black filmmakers. We see some of that in terms of crowdfunding for various projects. But we're going to have much more institutional and foundational support for folks to be able to tell their stories the way that they can, particularly at a period in time now when so many folks have access to the materials of making film.
All right, Mark, I'm going to have to cut it off there, and I'm very sorry to do it. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, back channel today on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. Thanks for being on the program. Thank you for listening. I'm Frank Stachow.